Thank you, Jorge, and welcome to everybody. And I'm not going to be able to see you the way it looks out there with those bright lights, but it feels a little bit like giving the sermon at the 7 a.m. church service here, I think, today. But if you want to move forward, please feel free to do so. What I'm going to talk to you about today is Midwest biomass, the past, the present, the future. We're going to talk then some about the sustainable corn stover harvest research that myself and my colleagues have been conducting over the past 6 or 7 years, looking at some of the NRCS guidelines and programs available to help biomass suppliers, and end on reviewing some of the critical soil and water research needed for sustainable biomass supplies. Of course, in the Midwest, biomass is not a new commodity. Our Native Americans managed it quite well for several thousand years with the buffalo. However, we're not in that same kind of a Midwestern landscape now. It's much more like this, with our rotation basically being in one field corn, or one row corn on the left and soybean on the right, and then diversity is switching the corn to the right and the soybean on the left. But corn and soybean have become the dominant crops simply because of the soil resources, the climate, and of course the infrastructure that exists to handle that crop and commodities. And as I often mention, every one of us have benefited immensely from the development of those two crops, from the Pampers to the salad dressing that we have to choose. There's many, many benefits that we've all obtained by the progress made with those two crops. But you can't grow those two crops alone across the entire landscape, simply because the success of those have also disrupted ecosystem services. The growing demand for biomass, now for both biofuel and bioproducts, I look at it as a positive sense in terms of soil and water conservation and crop management, because it creates opportunities to optimize new and innovative cropping systems. And of course, integrating food, feed, and fuel production in a proper and balanced manner can improve not only productivity of the entire region, but also ecosystem services. A lot of these were the conclusions drawn in the 2010 SWCS conference as part of the Midwest Regional Roadmap there that was put out. So where are we going in the Midwest? Well, cropping systems must provide sustainable supplies of both feed and fuel. We have to have the feed because food production must double to meet the demands of 9 billion people. But we also have to have, in concert with the feed and the fuel, with the feed and the food, the fuel, because the fuel is needed to supply the energy that rich societies need. Rich societies, if you're going to have economic development and growth, rich societies need energy, because energy is directly related to the rate of doing work. Energy use and human development opportunities are strongly correlated, and having renewable energy is the only way, in my opinion, that 9 billion people can achieve their full potential. You can find all kinds of writings on peak oil, but in my co-authors, in my opinion, peak oil really has arrived already. If you look at the graph here from my co-author Bruce Dale there, you can see the Texas oil fields basically peaked in the early 70s, the Alaska oil fields in the early 90s. We've got the tight oil now in the Dakota shales and other places like that, but those are also finite amounts. And quite frankly, it may not be in our grandchildren's generation, definitely won't be probably in our generation, but petroleum is a finite resource, whether we like to admit it or not. They're not making any more of that stuff underneath the ground. And only large-scale, low-cost, low-carbon energy sources are going to be able to reduce the impacts of the greenhouse gas. And those same fuels provide the energy security and long-term wealth that is essential for growing economies. Biofuels, therefore, from plant materials are not optional. And I've stressed that. For we in soil and water conservation, it's not don't do it. We have to figure out a way to have them. But they must be made available in a balance so that everything is more sustainable. Along that line, then, we need to look at all types of biomass resources. Obviously, corn stover is the one that you see in the press right now and is the most dominant because it's a lot of corn out there across the country, and it's the low-hanging fruit, so to speak. Also, in other parts, you pick up the switchgrass, the miscanthus. Pick it up into the northeast, the northwest part of the U.S. there, you get in the southern region a lot more of the woody species. And then you also have the other alternatives for the landscape of the oil seeds to produce bioenergy from, the canola, the pennycress, the camellia, what at one time were called minor crops. They're specialty crops. They're the ones that also need to be part of the landscape model system. U.S. EPA and others identified corn stover as the starting point, is the way I like to look at it. Mainly because of the extensive area on which corn is grown. And what we need to do again with the initial efforts on ethanol is to develop the technologies that are going to be needed to solve the long-range plans. We've known as humankind a long time how to make ethanol. And it's a starting point. It's not the end point. I think that's a very important concept to take home with you. The relatively high productivity of corn, 11.9 billion bushels on average for the 2011 to 2013. If you put the harvest index of 0.5 on there, that's a potential of 282 million tons per year of stover. Obviously, I'm not talking about taking all of that. There's no way you'd want to take all of that. But this is it helps you set the magnitude of why the initial efforts have focused on that resource. And the potential, of course, of taking a portion of the stover in areas where we have residue management problems. And yes, you can have too much residue. You move into irrigated areas, high-yield areas. I've had many calls over the years of how much more tillage should I do? Should I buy this bigger, deeper, more aggressive machine to get rid of the residue? I usually try to advise them I would rather have you consider removing a portion of the above-ground residue and not tilling and leaving the roots in place, which are already interfaced with the soil particles and improving soil health and soil quality. As I said, stover is important as a potential fuel source, but it's also important for soil health. These are a couple examples, not examples that I like to share with a lot of pride, but it's what's out there in the real world. Taking off too much, having the ground too bare there in Iowa during the winter season and the snow melt and the intense rains and the ice melt and the runoff and the erosion, it makes me sick as a soil water specialist. The two pictures from Greene County, Wisconsin, that's my home area, and my brother was doing some contract work with this farmer. The combine couldn't climb the hill. It was that steep. Why are we having policies to support corn crops on places like that allow growers to make the wrong decisions for how they use their land? Because we recognize, as soil and water conservation scientists, that excessive stover harvest can result quite early in degraded soil structure and aggregation. You degrade the structure and aggregation, you're going to have more compaction and crusting. You seal the surface, and you're going to have an increased wind and water erosion. The plants aren't going to germinate, you're going to have reduced plant growth. You don't have the root exudates any longer, you're going to impair soil biology. You're then going to decrease yield further, and you're going to further reduce productivity, and it becomes just a negative spiral downward in terms of your soil health, soil quality. The work that we've been doing with sustainable stover harvest has been a diverse regional partnership in a combination of USDA, ARS, Resilient Economic Agricultural Practices Team, their ARS REAP team, and university partners as part of the Sun Grant Association. Work at 36 locations across seven different states there. This just shows some of the many ways in which we've looked at stover harvest, those on the left being a single-pass operation, that we're using in Iowa and Minnesota there, in collaboration with that with Stuart Burrell and Hagen Biosystems Engineering, using some of the more standard ones of the flail choppers or the stack hands there in the middle. The one at the bottom center there, that's the one we affectionately call the diaper method. That one was used by our colleagues in Florence, South Carolina, on small plot scale. It's really good technique if you need to study crop residue removal because you catch it all within your plot. But I can't convince too many Iowa farmers to put a canvas on behind their combine there. It tends to fill up a little fast. So then you see our industry partners, how they're moving into the baling operations there, either two-pass or even single-pass. So in the Corn Stover project, we compiled over 239 site years of harvest data. We looked at the effects on subsequent grain and stover yields, the effects on soil organic carbon and aggregation, on the microbial community, and greenhouse gas emissions. We don't have time at this presentation to go over all the different data and pieces that have been collected, but there's a very good summary that the team has put together in Bioenergy Research, Volume 2 of this year, and I encourage you to peruse through the 14 papers that are published there as an outcome of this team. We also developed the Landscape Environmental Assessment Framework, or LEAF, and other tools which are being used very successfully to estimate the available residue in fields, to quantify economics, and to ensure ecosystem service benefits are sustained. And the way LEAF functions is it pulls down lots of data models, lots of information from the soil conditions, and you can get down to really guiding subfield management, which is the direction for the future. All of this work, again, it involved ARS, Department of Energy, university, and private industry partners. So what did we learn? The grain yields across these many locations ranged from 5 to 14 megagrams per hectare. The grain yield response to either no, an average of moderate removal, which is 3.9 megagrams per hectare, or high removal, 7.2. Actually, the grain yield response was minimal, about 9.8 to 10.1 for all three of those removal ones over the five-year period that this data was collected. However, sustainable stover harvest rates must be site-specific, because those averages are meaningless. Oftentimes with my producer audiences, I'll use the analogy that if I hold a piece of dry ice in this hand and a molten rod in this hand, on average I'll feel pretty darn good, but I don't think my hands will feel very good. Appropriate residue harvest may encourage the Midwest producers to adopt no-till corn production practices because, again, as we mentioned earlier, if you've got residue management problems and you take an appropriate amount off, then you can move into systems where it is not a problem for the subsequent crops, either in cool soil temperatures or other aspects of nitrogen immobilization, etc. Some other lessons we've learned, including the soil health one, is that compared to harvesting only the grain, when you move into a residue harvest situation, you're going to increase your nutrient removal. This is one that people in the industry weren't expecting at first, but you're going to increase it on average by at least 16 kilograms per megagram of residue of nitrogen, 2 of phosphorus, and 18 of potassium there. The team put together from 35 study sites an average amount of minimum return residue that you need of 6.4 plus or minus 2.2 megagrams per hectare. This translates roughly to the same amount of residue, 3.85 tons per acre, that you'd have with a 120 bushel corn crop. For grain yields less than 11 megagrams per hectare, or 175 bushels per acre, even at that level, which is higher than the one above there, 10 years of stover harvest, even with no tillage, resulted in reduced particulate organic matter. So again, it's a site-specific part of it. This was one of the locations. It was more arid, but the average yields were below that. If you had the average yields above that level, again, then your tendency is less. So again, it has to be site-specific. Low corn yields shifted the dry aggregate distribution towards smaller aggregates. Smaller aggregates lead to more wind erosion. Insufficient yields resulted in undesirable shifts in the microbial community. And, of course, the research also showed that some of the early projections on how much residue could be harvested was a little bit excessive, simply because of weather-induced yield variability and the other areas and what is really required. This is sort of the mantra that came out of the work, and that we really need to encourage the entire industry to look at this balance and strategies to ensure sustainability. Bioprocessing companies look at that economics arrow going up, and they want to push the amount that comes off the land for the logistics, the contracts, the amount they have to deliver, the harvesting strategies, and things like that. We as soil scientists and soil water scientists are going to focus on the limiting factors, the soil organic carbon changes, the erosion, the nutrients, the soil water temperature, compaction, environmental degradation. But it's by developing a balance between those with innovative agronomic strategies, diverse cropping systems, landscape changes, that we can then bring this back up to that necessary goal of achieving both sustainable food, feed, and fuel production. The goal, then, is landscape, scale, complementary and beneficial changes that can meet all of the needs to provide the food or feed and the fuel, and, of course, the rural economic development and better social outcomes through a diversity of how we approach this Midwest management of biomasses. One strategy that's getting a lot of attention right now is the double cropping and the use of cover crops there. The growing of rye, triticale, the brassicas during the winter on what was generally dedicated corn and soybean land. This is an option because it doesn't require new land, increases the sustainable corn stover harvest rate in many locations. It provides additional biomass for biofuels, animal feeds, etc., and it reframes the food versus fuel debate. It's how do we make the choices to use the land resources, the water resources that we have. Another one is what we call a shift in the alfalfa paradigm. Traditionally, alfalfa was grown strictly for the feeding to livestock and the production of milk, but we're looking now at strategies to have a new path whereby you change the harvest strategy by stripping the leaves and collecting the stems separately. It's technology that was tried in the past with the dehype plants and things like that, but there's some new thinking about how that might be used, because if you can separate the two, there's a lot of issues associated with the type of nutrition that different animal groups need, so that you can actually bring it back together if your goal is still the milk production. But if you separate the harvest strategy and get the leaves and the stems separately, it gives you opportunities for those industrial uses, which again leads to that goal of diversifying the landscape, providing feedstock, improving soil health, and protecting water quality through a shift. The models, as I mentioned earlier, LEAF, this brings together a whole number of other models, and it's called a framework because it links together several different types of models there to help lead us to the subfield decision support decisions that we're using, and can actually pick the areas within a farm. For example, one of the farms that we use many times for our model, it has about a 15-acre ridge out of the 140 acres that loses money every year and has high erosion, has a lot of poor soil health. Well, if you put that part of the field into, now that we have opportunities coming on for use of biomass, put that into switchgrass, you could stop losing money for the farmer, you could provide better conservation of that part of the field, and you've got economic resources for the farmer. Some of the guidelines, some of the opportunities and programs that the NRCS and FSA offer to support biomass production, they are ones focused on energy crops, both the woody species, the cottonwood, the poplars, the maple, locust, sweet gum, eucalyptus, also on the herbaceous ones, the switchgrass, bluestem, reed canary grass, and of course residues from annual crops. There's all kinds of programs out there that have some guidelines that are available. The biomass crops must be grown, however, in ways that ensure environmental and economic sustainability with minimal or no adverse effects on natural ecosystems, biodiversity, and with minimal reliance on any single crop. It has to be diverse. The Other ones, these programs include the CSP, the CWIP programs, Conservation Innovation Grants, the Regional Conservation Partnership programs, the BCAP ones, which were help with the establishment costs, the maintenance costs, and the retrieval and matching parts of that. So as we lead then to some of the research needs associated with biomass management, we need effective and efficient strategies for using no-tillage and cover crops in the current over-harvest systems. Innovative harvest, densification, uses, and site-specific placement guidelines for all biomass crops. We need to continue research on the improvement of herbaceous and woody biomass cultivars with higher yield potential and better biofuel bioproduct characterizations. Quantification of habitat. Can't forget the wildlife as part of our land use systems. Quantification of the runoff, the nutrient loss, the pesticide loss with biomass, and looking for options that enhance the value of marginal lands. In summary, renewable energy is essential for human well-being. To achieve that, biofuels, that's liquid fuels from plant material, are not optional. We must have them. But they must be truly sustainable. Sustainable economically, environmentally, and socially. And so in concluding, if we borrow from the Wizard of Oz, if we only had a brain, my co-authors and I conclude that any perceived food versus fuel conflict can be solved without having a negative impact on soil, water, or air resources by simply using our heads to design the best use for every landscape. With that, again, developing sustainable stover harvest strategies was just the first step toward developing and solving multiple energy and ecosystem challenges. Thank you.
Let's take one question. Is there any question out there for Doug? I was going to ask him one, but.
The question was, with the stover harvest, have we been also looking at the non-volatile nutrients, the potassium, the phosphorus removals also? Yes, that has been part of the REAP team studies. We've had, there's something like, of the, in addition to the nutrients, usually about 15 to 20 different potential soil quality indicators that get looked at these different sites. And as I mentioned earlier there, again, take it for what it's worth. On average, per ton of stover that you take off, you're going to take about 15 pounds of additional nitrogen above and beyond the grain, about 2 pounds of phosphorus, and about 18 to 20 pounds of potassium. And I'm the first to admit, the very first year that I ran one of these removal studies, DOE came to me in August and said, can we start giving them data to support the billion-ton study? And so Stuart and I put out a study, and we took off varying levels of residue that fall in 2005. 2006, that field rotated over to soybean. In our high removal area, the soybean yielded about two-thirds of the non-removal areas, and I was shocked. I just didn't expect it to fall that fast. What it was, however, is that field had been managed at a low, very low maintenance level. Actually, when we got the soil test back post-mortem, it was very low in potassium, and that extra pull, that extra draw of the potassium, was enough to take us over the edge. So the guidelines, we say, is before you enter into any kind of a stover harvest, make sure you've got good nutrient management, land management records and plans, and you know what you're doing. It's not a practice you go into blindly, unless you want to risk major problems. Has to have the understanding.
Thank you, Doug.